Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
That's right, we're in here, in the studio rather, with Marcus Jones. Hello, how are you?
Good, very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good, and we're talking today about, what are we talking about? We're talking about the Nobel Prize.
We're talking about two of the Nobel Prizes that have been given out so far. Okay. So we've had physiology or medicine, it's called, so that was yesterday, and or yesterday morning, and or last night, yesterday evening, and then physics was the day later, and I just want to just describe a little bit about what the prizes were for.
Please do.
So the medicine one was to three guys who did work on how the body senses when there's low levels of oxygen.
Okay.
So when your body is hypoxic, so there's low oxygen levels.
Okay.
And this is, so their work led to a better understanding of how the genes in the body are regulated, and especially the one for a hormone called EPO, which controls the amount of red blood cells that we have. This was work that started sort of in the 1980s, and they pinpointed the proteins that bind to regions of the EPO gene when there is not so much oxygen there, and makes it produce more red blood cells, so the body can sort of compensate for having low oxygen levels.
Right.
And this is important because low oxygen levels are associated with often with diseases like cancer. So in tumors, there tends to be hypoxic areas in the body that ultimately lead to tumors. It's involved in strokes, in inflammation, in wound healing, in all sorts of arterial diseases, and so being able to control, you know, how the body responds to low oxygen levels and sense it and things like that is really, really important. And so these guys were honored a couple of days ago for sort of that pioneering work.
And so what are their names, sorry?
Their names, I didn't say that, did I? Their names are William Kalin Jr. And Peter Ragnar. So he works in Boston, in the US. Greg Semenza, who works in Johns Hopkins University, also in the US. And a guy called Peter Radcliffe, who works at the University of Oxford in the UK.
Oh, yeah, a bit of a dude fest there.
As is typical, and we'll talk about that in a sec, I think.
Yeah. And so the next award.
Yeah, the next one is physics, and that was just announced late last night, and that goes to, again, three old white dudes. one of them called James Peebles, who works in the US at Princeton. He got sort of half the prize. So these are, the prizes are worth $900,000, so pretty sizable chunk of cash.
That's, I didn't know that they were cash prizes. That's a lot of money.
Oh yeah, they get a significant amount of money.
Bloody
yeah,
money. So a career change. We think.
Yeah, well, they're pretty easy to get, you know. So this one guy got half the prize, and that was for his work in fundamental sort of work in a field called cosmology, which looks at the whole universe and how it works and things like that. And the other two split the other half between them. And they got it for their discovery of the first planet around a star that's not the sun.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll talk briefly about those guys. The first guy, James Peebles, works in the US again. He did some early work looking at essentially the afterglow of the Big Bang. So the Big Bang happened quite a long time ago, about 14 billion years ago. And it was a Big Bang.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. Yeah, and we can still detect the afterglow of that massive explosion as sort of the cooling occurs over billions of years.
Right.
And he described it, worked out what it should look like, described how there should be fluctuations in it, and invoked all sorts of theories, including Einstein's theories, to try and work this all out. And a lot of his work was confirmed by more modern observations, including the WMAP study, which studied sort of the whole sky and looked at the microwave. This is called the cosmic microwave background, and they found a lot of the things that he predicted. And so his award is really sort of for a lifetime's work in this field. The other two guys are called Michael Mayer and Didier Queloz in Geneva, in Switzerland.
Mm.
Yeah, for a change. And what they did was, for the first time, so we all know there's planets orbiting our sun,
yeah,
and we can see them. Many of them we can see with the naked eye. But it was always assumed that there would be planets orbiting other stars. But that's very, very, very difficult to observe because, first of all, they're a long, long way away,
yep,
light years away, hundreds of light years away often. The stars are extremely bright compared to the planets. And the distance, the separation between star and planet at that distance is just minuscule.
I still don't even understand the bloody process of how they know that something is what it is just through a little telescope. You know what I mean? It's all very sort of confusing for me. That's why my eyes are glazing over. I just want to apologize.
That's all right. Yeah. Well, these guys looked at a particular star, and they very, very carefully pinpointed the position of that star. And what they looked at it is how that star was wobbling just a little bit when the planet went around it.
Yeah? Okay.
So I'm doing the hand actions while I'm talking. And so as the planet orbits the star, the star wobbles a little bit in its position, and it was that wobble that could be detected from Earth. And judging by how much it was wobbling and the frequency and things like that, they could figure out that it was a massive gas giant, a little bit like Jupiter,
right?
But it was orbiting extremely close to the star. So in fact, it was almost grazing the surface of the star. Yeah, and that was very unexpected because people didn't think that gas giants could form so close to the parent stars, and it opened up the ideas of how planets could form and things like that. But this was the first observation. Since then, there have been hundreds, thousands of observations of planets around other stars, but this was the first.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we both kind of brought up a point earlier about how this is a bit of a dude fest. So
it is.
I want to know your opinion on that. What do you think that is?
Well, so I've got some statistics. To illustrate the magnitude of the sort of the discrepancy here. There are six Nobel Prizes: chemistry, economics, literature, and peace, which we haven't talked about, and then physics and physiology, medicine. And in the last 118 years of awarding Nobel Prizes, so since 1901, there have been five women who have been awarded the chemistry prize. There's just been one woman who's won economics, 14 literature, 17 peace, so a little bit more, but still not nearly 50%. Only three physics prizes have gone to women, 12 medicine prizes. So these are very, very, very underrepresented. Women are very underrepresented in the Nobel Prizes. And last year, everyone was celebrating because two women won prizes, one in physics and one in economics. But this was an anomalous year. And so far, we've only had two prizes, but we've had six old white men winning these prizes.
And what do you think that is? Do you think that that's a systemic problem? Do you think that the way that they judge the people who are going to get awards, do you think it's the problem's there, or what would you say?
I think this is a complicated thing. I think there is from the school level, women are perceived as being not as good in certainly the natural sciences and things like that, the hard sciences or physics and chemistry, that sort of thing. It doesn't explain physiology and medicine or the other prizes. I think there are when women transfer into academia, there are systemic issues that limit their careers, make it harder for women to progress than men. The fact that many, I think, an anomalous proportion of the women who have won Nobel Prizes have been unmarried and haven't had children, that indicates that the whole process of women wanting to have children, obviously, and getting married and doing that sort of thing is maybe restricts a woman's career in science.
Right.
There are certainly biases that I think science in general, maybe the Nobel Committee in general, but certainly men in science have against women, and unconscious or unconscious, that severely restrict careers, their careers.
And so, what are the solutions to that? How would you resolve that?
Very good question. Mm. I think being open to it, being open to the causes, being trying to understand what is leading to this, and positively discriminating towards women instead of against women. If on hiring committees, if there's two choices, one woman, one man, hire the woman. If they're of equal standard. If there are, look at your promotional sort of regulations in your university and think, okay, well, what are we doing here that are limiting the number of women who are making full professor? I mean, the illustration last year, a woman called Donna Strickland won the prize for physics. Mm-hmm. She was Canadian. She was at University of Waterloo, but she hadn't made full professor. She was still an associate professor. She wasn't at the top of her academic sort of promotion scale.
Right.
Very, very soon after, I think she got promoted. I mean, yeah. You won a Nobel Prize. You
Fair
should
enough.
Probably be a full professor. But it's sort of illustrative of the fact that for whatever reason, she either hadn't applied or she just couldn't be, didn't want to fight the process or whatever it was. And the university hadn't recognized the fact that she had such a successful sort of an illustrious career. They hadn't approached her and said, hey, you should be full professor here. So maybe that's sort of illustrative of some of the institutional biases, some of the unconscious biases that exist in academia especially.
It's a very, very interesting topic, and maybe we can touch on that in later shows. I find that personally really, really interesting. So thank you for your time, Marcus.
Very welcome.
I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Have a lovely day.
You too.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
This week at the